Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter. Pretty good Bible studies. We are now in Nehemiah chapter 11. I'm going to call this chapter the New Residence of Jerusalem. Our context is this. Of course, the wall has already been built, which is what the book of Nehemiah is mainly about. But also, we see in the previous chapter, the people of Israel have entered into a covenant with Yahweh to basically follow the law, keep the Sabbath, support the priest, don't intermarry with pagans and so forth, and that was the last chapter. This came after the Israelites had confessed their sins, weeping and wailing after the Feast of Tabernacles in Tishri, the same Tishri after which the wall was completed. Chapter 8, we have Ezra reading the law to the people. So that's basically our context. We start now in Nehemiah chapter 11, verses 1 through 2. Now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, but the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9/10 remained in the other cities, and the people blessed all the men who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. So the leaders of the people were living in Jerusalem, because that's where all the activity was, as they tried to rebuild the walls. That's where all the danger was, because that's where the attacks came from the surrounding pagan governors of the surrounding provinces like Samaria in the north. And so, because there were not enough people to live in Jerusalem, we see here in Nehemiah 11, verses 1 and 2, that people are brought from the surrounding areas of Jerusalem into the city in order to build up its population. Now, these rest of the people, besides the leaders, who were living outside of Jerusalem, cast lots to decide who's going to come to live in Jerusalem. 1 out of 10 were chosen. 10% of the surrounding people came to live in Jerusalem. Now, these lots, this procedure of casting lots was considered to be directed by God and not by chance, of course, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. They had to choose by lot because people seldom like living in insecure areas, and Jerusalem was indeed insecure. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, the enemies were constantly trying to tear down the walls. So Nehemiah strengthened the population so Jerusalem could defend itself. The NIV Study Bible estimates that after the in-migration, 5 to 8,000 people lived in the city. In verses 4 through 18 in this chapter, a total of 3,044 men are mentioned as living in the city. That's NIV Study Bible's calculation. Now, Jerusalem is called the Holy City in verse 1. Why? Because the temple was there. That's why. Verse 2 says, and the people blessed all the men who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. Now we have a different category of people who went back to Jerusalem. We have people chosen by lot, and then we have volunteers that go back. Well, before we talk about who these volunteers are, we notice in verse 2 that the people blessed these volunteers. Why did they bless them? Because they put themselves to hardship to move in the city. It was safer in the surrounding areas. They would have to pick up from their farms and move. Moving is always hard for anybody. And so the rest of the people say, God bless you for moving into Jerusalem. Now, let's look at these volunteers. There's two options as to who these people are. They could be volunteers who were in addition to those people taken by lots. Pulpit commentator believes that. In fact, Kyle and Dillich say that most expositors hold to this option, that the volunteers were people who were taken afterwards. In other words, the people who were taken by lot were taken against their will, under constraint, but the people who volunteered went freely. That's the majority view. However, Kyle and Dillich and Ellicott take a minority view. They say that these volunteers were the same people as those taken by lots. Kyle and Dillich say it is not true that volunteers went first, and then those who were taken by lot came next. The lot was taken as a divine disposition, say Kyle and Dillich, and not as a constraint. The people were not forced to go by lot. I tend to take the minority view here. I think the people who were taken by lot also volunteered. I think they said, yeah, we'll subject ourselves to the lot. If we get chosen, we'll go. It's a close question. At any rate, Jerusalem is getting repopulated. We go now to Nehemiah 11, verses 3 and 4. These are the heads of the province who stayed in Jerusalem, but in the villages of Judah, each lived on his own property in their towns. Now, right now, let's distinguish two things. Verse 3 is talking about the people who lived in Jerusalem. We're going to talk about who they are. And then there's a parenthesis, and we're going to distinguish the people who are in Jerusalem from the people who live outside of Jerusalem in the villages of Judah. Verse 3, but in the villages of Judah, each lived on his own property in their towns, the Israelites, priests, Levites, temple servants, and descendants of Solomon's servants, while some of the descendants of Judah and Benjamin settled in Jerusalem. So you see the distinction, those who are in Jerusalem and those who are outside. And then Judah's descendants and the names are listed. I'm not going to read the names. So verse 3 says, these are the heads of the province who stayed in Jerusalem. And then you got all these names that come later. I'm not going to read them to you, but I will say this. The list here in chapter 11 differs from the list in 1 Chronicles 9, 1 through 9. Let me read you the first three verses of 1 Chronicles 9. All Israel was registered in the genealogies that are written in the book of the kings of Israel, but Judah was exiled to Babylon because of their unfaithfulness. The first to live in their towns on their own property again were Israelites, priests, Levites, and temple servants. That language is very similar to what we just read in Nehemiah. These peoples from the descendants of Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh settled in Jerusalem. I don't know why Ephraim and Manasseh are listed here in addition to Judah and Benjamin in 1 Chronicles 9, but at any rate, you have a list. It's supposedly the same list, but there are some differences. Here are methods to reconcile those differences, and this is from Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown, suggested by them. Option number one, in 1 Chronicles 9, only those who came with Zerubbabel were enumerated, but here in Nehemiah, Zerubbabel's 538 B.C., Ezra's 458 B.C., and Nehemiah 445/444, all of those returnees are all listed together, so it includes later returnees as well as the original returnees. Option number two to reconcile the two lists of names. Jews and other Orientals would change their names after a change in circumstances, so you might have some name changes which create differences in the two lists. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's suggestion. Option number three to reconcile Nehemiah chapter 11 and 1 Chronicles 9, first part of 1 Chronicles 9, is that this list, the Nehemiah list, was made out and constructed after the 1 Chronicles 9 list. Some had died since 1 Chronicles 9. Some had changed their minds about going. And so they had other names inserted in their place. So we don't expect the list to be exactly the same because they are variable circumstances. Now in verse 3, the text says, these are the heads of the province who stayed in Jerusalem, not the heads of the tribes. Why would province be used there instead of tribes? Well, it's because Nehemiah is referring to the status of that area under the Persian Empire, or is referring to the status of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin under the Persian Empire. They're called provinces. This is the province of Judah. This is the province of Benjamin. Now, there's a translation difference here. The King James has the province, the heads of the province who stayed in Jerusalem. The NASB has the heads of the provinces, plural. If the NASB is correct in it, it's supposed to be provinces. I would say the provinces probably refer to Judah and Benjamin, although I haven't seen a commentary comment on that. Now, of these people living outside of Jerusalem, they are described as Israelites, priests, Levites, temple servants, and descendants of Solomon's servants. Now, we need to break that down a little bit. First of all, it says the Israelites. Well, that's kind of a strange general term, sort of broad. Well, the Poole commentator says Israel is used here rather than Judah because many of the other tribes are now living in the land, whereas only members of Judah and Benjamin are living in Jerusalem. That would assume that refugees from perhaps Simeon in the south, but also the 10 northern tribes from up there somehow made their way to Babylon after 722 BC, and they came back maintaining their ancestry, and they're living all outside of Jerusalem. So they're called Israelites now instead of Judahites. As a matter of fact, before the division of the kingdom under Rehoboam in 930 B.C. between Rehoboam in the south and Jeroboam the first in the north, the Jews were called Israelites. But after the division, Israel, of course, the term Israel referred only to the northern kingdom. But now the term Israel refers to all the Jews together. All traces of their former separation have now been obliterated. So it's Israel. I've been calling them Israel. Sometimes the text calls them Judah. Doesn't matter now. There's no more division. The two sticks have become one stick. Now then, priests or Levites are living out in the hinterlands of Jerusalem, of course, and then temple servants, those are the Nethinim. We've mentioned them a good bit going through Ezra and Nehemiah. The Ethinim are temple servants who help the Levites in the service of the temple. The Levites, of course, helping the priests. Some people dispute whether the Nethinim are Levites or non-Levites. I'm going to assume they're Levites. But now, who are these descendants of Solomon's servants that are mentioned? Well, one of my commentators, I've lost the site, says that, quote, these people weren't likely descendants simply from Solomon's court servants. More likely, this refers to Canaanite people Solomon had forced into slavery and who had eventually become part of the Israelite nation. So it would read the descendants of Solomon's slaves, Canaanite slaves. I don't think that's accurate. I think that more probably the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia describes who these descendants of Solomon's servants were, and in their article they capitalized Solomon's servants to show that they were a special class of people like the Nethinim were. And the idea is Solomon's servants helped the Nethinim helped the Levites helped the priest. So at the bottom of the totem pole here is the Solomon's servants who really do the hard work of maintaining the temple. Let me read through ISBE's International Standard Bible Encyclopedia's description of Solomon's servants. They constituted a company or guild of the Jewish exiles who returned with Zerubbabel in 538 BC. They're mentioned five times in Ezra and Nehemiah, as the prime purpose of the returning exiles was the rebuilding of the temple. It was important that those who held the privileges of sanctuary service as a family heritage should go back to their duties. That, of course, included priests and Levites and the Nethinim, but also Solomon's servants. Solomon had appointed them, and so their descendants are still marked out as those who are going to serve in the temple. In every reference to Solomon's servants, they are connected with the Nethinim. So Solomon's servants traced, capital S, Solomon's servants traced their official beginning back to Solomon's appointment, as their name indicates. In the joint references with the Nethinim, they always fall into the natural chronological order, following the Nethinim. What their duties in the house of God may have been is not stated in the records. These duties must have been more or less menial, the more formal and honorable duties being reserved for the priests and Levites, the singers and porters, or the doorkeepers. When the ark was brought to Jerusalem by David and the ceremonial of the sacrificial system was more strictly observed, the services of priests and Levites was greatly increased, and to meet the needs of the new order, David appointed the Nethinim. Likewise, the much greater increase in such duties on the completion of Solomon's temple was the occasion for the dedication of an additional number of these assistants to the Levites, Solomon's servants. So basically, if we remember this, David brings the tabernacle back into Jerusalem. We need some more people to help the Levites, so we'll appoint some temple servants, Nethinim. Then, after Solomon builds his huge, humongous temple, we need some more people to help the Nethinim out, so Solomon appoints Solomon's servants. We go now to Nehemiah 11, 5 through 19. It's a list of names, and I am not going to read them to save you a lot of misery. I'll go through and pick out some interesting things if I can. Verse 6, it says, all the sons of Perez. Well, Perez was the son of Judah, so I don't know why. The list here doesn't just say all the sons of Judah, but it says of Perez, because we're looking at two tribes here, Judah and Benjamin. Those are the two tribes that are going to live in Jerusalem. And that makes sense, because pre-exile, before the city was destroyed, Judah and Benjamin were the two tribes that possessed Jerusalem. I saw a map one time and saw the boundary line of Judah and Benjamin running right through the middle of Jerusalem. That was the first time I had realized that both Benjamin and Judah had the city of Jerusalem. I had previously thought it was just Judah, but no, they both did. And so now we're going to look at Judah and Benjamin, starting in verse 6 with the sons of Perez, who were sons of Judah. There were 468 able men, not a lot, 468. Verse 7, now these are the sons of Benjamin. So now we go to Benjamin. And their names are listed, 928. Interesting, more Benjamites. I've noticed something interesting. Sometimes, either the commentators or the translations, I'm not sure which, sometimes they say Benjaminites with the I-N in there, or sometimes they just say Benjamites. I'm going to use both because I can't ever remember. But there's more Benjaminites than people from Judah. Maybe they had a greater share allotted to them for some reason unknown to us. Maybe more of them preferred to live in Jerusalem. So maybe it's just a random thing. I can't get any significance out of it. In verse 9, you got Joel, or Joel, was the overseer. That means the chief governor, the chief officer of the city. The NIV has chief officer. Let's just call him the mayor of Jerusalem. And then in verse 10, we go from Judah and Benjamin people to the priest. In verse 10, one of those priests is called Sareah. In verse 11, he's leader of the house of God. So Sareah had command over all secular matters of the temple. It doesn't mean he was a priest. The high priest had command over spiritual matters. And I don't know whatever happened to him. The last I heard of him, he was Eliashib, and he seems to have disappeared from the list. I think I read somewhere the speculation is that maybe there was some kind of defalcation in his duty. Maybe he did something bad and got booted. But anyway, the priests are mentioned and listed, lots of names. And we go down to the Levites in verse 15. They're listed, lots of names. In verse 12, the priests are said to perform the work of the temple. What kind of work is involved in the temple? Well, that's offering sacrifices, burning incense, setting up the showbread, lighting the lamps, and so forth. The Levites, in verse 16, are said to be in charge of the outside work of the house of God, of the temple. What's the outside work? Well, repairing the temple, getting wood in for the altar, collecting contributions, that one-third shekel upkeep that Nehemiah and the people have agreed to pay. Used to be a half shekel, now it's a third shekel. It was legally a half shekel, but they decided to take up a third shekel, probably because they were poor. The Levites took that money. They had to buy things that were being used in the temple, whether it's utensils or pots or pans or whatever. So that was the outside work done by the Levites. Now in verse 17, we got a gentleman named Mattaniah, who was the leader in beginning the thanksgiving at prayer. Now, that's probably the leader of singing at the time of the daily sacrifice, morning and evening sacrifice. This is according to Gill and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown. And then in verse 17, we have Babukia, the second among his brethren. In other words, the brethren are the sons of Asaph, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But Mattaniah was the first of the descendants of Asaph. The second singer, who was a descendant of Asaph, was named Babukia, and the third is named Abda. Now, Abda was the third of the three principal singers. To me, it's very interesting to see how important singing was in the temple service. Three leaders of singing are listed out, number one, number two, and number three, Mattaniah, Bakbukaya, and Abda. Now, they were called the sons of Asaph. Well, who is this Asaph? Well, I will talk about the sons of Asaph as we get into our next section of scripture here in chapter 11 of Nehemiah, verses 20 through 36, which is basically a continuation of a very long list of names. Some other sons of Asaph are mentioned in verse 22. Now, the overseer of the Levites in Jerusalem was Uzi, the son of Benai, the son of Hashabiah, the son of Mattaniah, the son of Micah, from the sons of Asaph. Uzi, U-Z-Z-I, was the overseer of the singers, and the singers were Levites. And he was from the sons of Asaph. So now we got those three principal singers I just mentioned, whose names I can hardly remember, Mattaniah, Bakbukbai, and Abda, and now we got Uzi. So, now, who are these sons of Asaph? Well, now, there was an older Asaph back in the times of David. Remember, David ruled from 1010 to 970 B.C. I'm going to call him David's Asaph. Now, this Asaph apparently wrote about 11 psalms, Psalm 50 and Psalm 73 to 83. That's 12 psalms. So he was an important musical and poetic character in the time of David. We read in 2 Chronicles 29:30, then King Hezekiah and the officials told the Levites to sing praise to the Lord in the words of David and of Asaph the seer. So David's Asaph was also a prophet. So, later on, during the times of King Hezekiah, they sang praises with rejoicing and bowed down in worship. Now, these sons of Asaph are mentioned not only in Nehemiah here, that I've just pointed out as we've gone through our verses, but also in 2 Chronicles and Ezra. In 2 Chronicles 20:14, we read this, "In the middle of the congregation, the Spirit of the Lord came on Jehaziel, son of Zechariah, son of Benaiah, son of Jeiel, son of Mattaniah, Mattaniah, a Levite from Asaph's descendants." Now, this was at the time of Jehoshaphat, who ruled in 870 to 848, so this is a long time, about four centuries before where we are now. But it's interesting, Mattaniah, that name sounds familiar. He was the singer here in the times of Nehemiah, a Levite from Asaph's descendants. So apparently this singing tradition carried on for traditions. Now, there's also a mention of the sons of Asaph or Asaph's descendants in Ezra 2:41. The singers included Asaph's descendants. So who were these sons of Asaph, or who were these descendants of Asaph? Sons of and descendants of is the same thing. Well, they could literally be blood descendants of David's Asaph, or, as Easton says, more likely, they were a class of poets and singers who recognized Asaph as their master. And so they just carried on the guild, if you will, kind of like the Bolshoi Ballet. Well, whoever they were prominent enough to write 12 psalms, which were inscripturated and put into our canon, so I think they are people worth knowing about. All right, some other points as we go through verses 20 through 36, and we'll finish up this audio. Verse 20 says, the rest of Israel, that refers to all besides those who were living in Jerusalem, and the priests and the Levites, each were living on his own inheritance. That would be referring to their ancestral estates that they owned before the Babylonian exile, before the Babylonians came and wiped out their ancestral estates. So they got their land back. Verse 21, but the temple servants, that's the Nethinim, were living in Ophel, O-P-H-E-L. That was a high place or a tower on the wall of Jerusalem. I just think it's a wall, a northern wall, some kind of a fortification on the north of Mount Zion proper. That little piece of land that looks like California jutting down in the valley, jutting down between the two valleys, the Tyrrhenian Valley and the Kidron Valley, and its southern tip terminated at the Hinnom Valley, or right before the Hinnom Valley. That's Mount Zion. Well, right at the northern end of Mount Zion is the Temple Mount, Mount Moriah. Now, sometimes Mount Zion refers to the whole mountain range there, or hill. It's not really a mountain. It's more like a hill, but it's called Mount Zion. And the Temple Mount is the northern part. That's where the temple was located. And between Mount Moriah and Mount Zion was Ophel. And the temple servants, the Nethinim, lived there. That makes sense because Ophel is right north. As you go down the eastern wall of Mount Zion, you go down a little bit south and you hit the water gate and go out the water gate and you get the Gihon Spring, which was a main source of water. And these Nethinim had to carry water from the Gihon Spring through the water gate up to the Temple Mount, to the temple. And so they lived there. They lived in Ophel, which is in between the two, in between the Gihon Spring and the temple. Now in verse 23, we read this, for there was a commandment from the king concerning them. Concerning whom? These sons of Asaph that I've spent so much time talking about. A commandment from the king concerning the sons of Asaph and a firm regulation for the song leaders day by day. Well, somebody's regulating the worship. Who in the world is doing that? What king is doing that? Well, it could have been referring to David, who did that back in ancient times. Back in 1010 to 970 B.C., I don't think so, though I think this is talking about the current Persian king, who is Artaxerxes, who ruled from 465 to 424 B.C. He regulated the singing in the temple. Now you ask, well, why would a Persian king care about how the Jews sang in their temple? Well, because Persia's religious policy was different than most other empires. Persia tried to support local religions rather than scatter and destroy the people practicing those local religions. He wanted to keep them happy, to keep the peace. That's what Cyrus had done. He supported that temple, Ezra 6:9 through 10, whatever is needed, both young bulls and rams and lambs for a burnt offering to the God of heaven. This is in Cyrus's decree. Wheat, salt, wine, and anointing oil, as the priest in Jerusalem request, it is to be given to them daily without fail, that they may offer acceptable sacrifices to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. So you see, Cyrus was concerned about the temple ritual in Jerusalem. It makes sense that Artaxerxes would be concerned about how the singing was done in said temple. The commandment that the king issued, what was it? Well, it could have been that singing would be practiced, just a general command, you're going to sing, or it could be a command that funding for the singers might be provided, or both. In verse 24, a gentleman named Pethahiah was the king's representative in all matters. That's Artaxerxes, and that's why I think the king is talking. The king that gave the command about the singing was the same king that's mentioned here in verse 24. That's obviously Artaxerxes, and so it makes sense just from the context that both kings there are Artaxerxes, And this commandment about the singing is not talking about David commanding the sons of Asaph in his day. So this Pethahiah spoke to the king of Persia, Artaxerxes, whenever the people had a problem. And Adam Clark says that Pethahiah no doubt fixed and levied and received the tribute from the people that had to be sent on to Persia. Because remember, the Israelites were, as Nehemiah put it one time, slaves of the Persians. I think that's a little histrionic because the Persians were being pretty nice to them. But they were subject to the Persians, and they had to pay the Persians tribute. Now, starting in verse 25, we have cities of Judah listed. And then when we get to verse 31, we have cities of Benjamin listed. And many of these cities are very familiar, at least to me, as I've gone through the podcast, trying to familiarize myself with geography. I'm not going to go over every city again. I've done that in previous podcasts, almost ad nauseum. But I will mention here, in verse 25, that sons of Judah lived in Kiriath Arba. Kiriath Arba is a famous place. It's still there, except it's called Hebron now. It's called Hebron in the scriptures, too. It's also known as Hebron, as well as Kiriath Arba. Kiriath Arba, I believe, was the former pagan town before the Jews took over Hebron, before they bought property there. And this is where Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebekah, and Leah are all buried. So this is the place of the tombs of the patriarch. It's still there. It's still a big tourist attraction. Notice the only two famous ancient Israelites that are left out are Joseph and Rachel. They were buried elsewhere. But Hebron is a place to go to if you can get there. I think it's in Palestine-occupied territory. I'm not sure you can get there. Now, one last verse, verse 36. From the Levites, some divisions in Judah belonged to Benjamin. Now, what does that mean? The NIV translates it as this. Some of the divisions of the Levites of Judah settled in Benjamin. In other words, the Levites were scattered about in both tribes for the better instruction of the people, because the Levites are those who taught the law, as well as the priest, but the Levites taught the law, and so they were both in Judah and in Benjamin. And ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Nehemiah chapter 11, and we are prepared to go to Nehemiah chapter 12, verses 1 through 47. In our next audio, which we will entitle The Dedication of the Wall. I hope you stay tuned for that happy event, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.